Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking about geology. We're going to be talking about glaciers. We're going to be talking about the Antarctic. And to take us through this sort of minefield of interesting ideas and areas and scientific results is Professor Ross Powell. He's a professor in the Department of Geology and Environmental Geosciences, Northern Illinois University in DeKalb, Illinois. So after all that introduction, Ross, welcome to Science Studio.
Hi, Keith. Great to be here.
Now, before we get on to any of the topics that I said we might cover, let's talk just a little bit about Ross. How did you get into the business of being a scientist? Our listeners always like to know, what are those interesting stories that sort of turned the tide for your interests?
Yeah, well, I don't know whether anybody picked up on such a short speak that I had before, but I'm originally a Kiwi. I've been over in the States for about 30-odd years now, but Kiwi is somebody who grows up in New Zealand, so it's not only Kiwi fruit, but there are people around called Kiwis as well. So anyway, yeah, I grew up in the capital city there, Wellington. There's a lot of outdoor activities in New Zealand, and so when I was younger growing up, I used to go hiking or, as we say there, tramping through the mountains on tracks, not trails, and I used to spend a lot of time outdoors, and being in New Zealand and outdoors, you get exposed to seeing a lot of things going on in nature, and that's what really triggered my interest in science. And I got really interested in New Zealand has had a very rugged time in terms of its geological history, and so there's lots of interesting mountains and rocks there, and so I got really intrigued about trying to understand what those interesting rocks, as I was walking past them, what they're actually all about. And so when I wanted to go on to my studies as a scientist at the university, I got into the geology program there. And for me, the rest was history, you know.
Okay.
The program that I went to there had a annual expedition down to the Antarctic, because New Zealand's had a long tradition of Antarctic exploration. The early explorers started off their trips from New Zealand, and so New Zealanders have always had a really strong interest in the Antarctic, because we're one of the closest countries to it.
Right, and a lot of people don't realize how tall and thin New Zealand is. You go up to Auckland and it's sort of subtropical. You can grow all sorts of interesting fruits. And then you go all the way down to Dunedin, and that's, what do they call it, the Scotland of New Zealand. It's
exactly.
Always cold and quite miserable.
Yeah,
so it's
exactly,
quite a big. What's the distance from the top to the bottom of New Zealand?
It's about 800 miles.
Oh, is that
like
all?
That. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay, forget it. It seems bigger.
Each island is about 400 miles long, something like 450 or something like that. But, yeah, it's narrow. I mean, no place in New Zealand is further than about 50 miles from the ocean. So,
okay, well, let's just jump to the quick here. So It was natural for a New Zealander from Wellington to think about the Antarctic, and then you went on an exhibition, and now that's basically a major part of your career.
Yeah, that's right. I got involved in the science. I applied for the expedition, and I felt very fortunate that I got selected to go down. It's really competitive because there's a lot of interest by students in getting down there. And so I went down there and started my research as a master's student, and it just developed from there. And I was really it happens to a lot of people when they first go down to the Antarctic that you really get captivated by the place. It's such a special and unique place that most people who go there want to get back.
Now, presumably you normally go in the summer.
Yeah, and that's the southern summer. So
right.
That's over our winter up here.
And so what is your particular fascination? How did your general fascination get into a career? What are you really are interested in about Antarctica?
Yeah, what I got twigged on in the science down there was how the ice worked and what the history of the ice has been. And from understanding a bit about how the ice works and what the history of the ice sheet has been, we can get a better idea of what will likely happen to it in the future. And so I started this well before the concerns of global warming. It was just getting really interested in understanding ice and the sediments that are formed from the ice movement across the land.
Well, yeah, but then that brings up the interesting point that not maybe everybody knows or remembers, put it that way, and that Antarctica is a continent of landmass, right? It's not like the Arctic with just an ice sheet. You know, this is over water. This is a real land-based continent.
Yeah, so that's a really important point, that most people don't know much about the polar regions because they don't live there. And so they are very different beasts, and so Santa Claus has a hard time living in the Arctic because he's floating on water all the time on ice that is actually frozen from seawater, whereas in the Antarctic, the continent is about 1.5 times the size of the U.S. So it's basically the size of the U.S. and Mexico. So it's a huge place, and most people don't understand that because it ends up being a strip along the bottom of a map, or else it's left off the map, you know. And then that's covered by ice that's between 1 and 2 miles thick.
That's just difficult for people to grasp with, 1 to 2 miles thick of ice.
Exactly, yeah, you know, the height of Denver or more.
Yeah, right, so I mean, one's not going to be looking at it in the near future as a source of minerals, for example. Mining would not really be very useful.
Well, you know, there are really potentially economic deposits down there. In the once Antarctica was joined together with Africa and India and South America, you know, in the continent of Gondwanaland that existed for a long time down there. And so a lot of the economic deposits that you know about, say, in Africa, such as diamonds and so on, could potentially be in the Antarctic and could be buried underneath the ice. However, there is a global treaty of the countries, and it's basically the Antarctic Treaty makes the Antarctic basically a world park. And so everybody agrees to not do any mineral or oil exploration down in the Antarctic.
Well, I mean, that's because it was almost technically impossible to do it. But I suppose, presumably, maybe, let me just be Machiavellian, if some amazing technique suddenly develops, maybe they'll sort of reinvestigate that concept.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about the ice then, the history of the ice.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the history of the ice? What are you learning about the history of the ice of 2 miles thickness in the Antarctic?
Yeah, people may not understand this either. There's lots of interesting facts about the Antarctic. And the ice has been on the continent for about 35 million years. To me, that's astounding. 35 million years, the continent has been covered with ice. The ice has varied in size, and it's not the oldest ice on the continent at the moment, right down at the bottom of the ice sheet. Of course, the ice sheet forms in onion layers, basically, sort of like tree rings, that the oldest ice is at the bottom, and then with each layer of snow, it builds up progressively. Over this 1 to 2 miles thickness, and so the ice is stacked up in annual layers, and the oldest ice down the bottom is close to 1 million years old.
So, in fact, that's really a reservoir of great information. I mean, tree rings are currently being, you know, measured, and the concentration of different elements to show when, you know, there was a lot of iodine in the air, when there was a lot of this, that, and the other in the air. Presumably, we can learn about the environment of the Earth from chemical analysis of the ice sheet.
Yeah, and that's exactly what scientists do. They set up a core system that is basically a steel barrel with cutting teeth on the bottom of it, and you rotate that around at the surface and drill through the ice, and then a cylinder of the ice goes up into the barrel, and then you pull that back up to the surface. And so you end up with a cylinder of ice or a core that goes down this mile or mile and a half or so down through the ice sheet. And basically, it's a time machine. You're going back in time as you're drilling down through the ice, through these layers. And what's really interesting scientifically about that is that as the snow falls, you have the down in El Paso, you occasionally have some snow.
We do, once every 2 years.
There you go.
And quite often at Christmas. I've had several white Christmases here, if you can believe it.
Yeah, there you go. So everybody knows what a snow crystal looks like, and as that snow falls, all of those little fine little crystals of ice actually trap the air in between the ice crystals. And as the snow compacts and slowly consolidates into ice, that air is actually trapped as gas bubbles inside the ice. And so what the ice ends up being is layer after layer after layer, year after year after year of the snowfall that then has samples of the Earth's atmosphere trapped inside it. And so it's a time machine of the composition of the Earth's atmosphere, and it provides one of the best records that we have of the history of the composition of the atmosphere going back close to a million years.
Well, let me just jump in there, because at some stage the surface must warm up just a little. I mean, there may be times when there's actually a thin layer of fluid material on the top, and I know ice is a fluid, and so therefore you can get materials sort of penetrating down into. So when you say you've got this tree ring concept, but some of the materials must merge, do you collect over a 100-year period or a 10-year period? Certainly don't do it yearly.
Up at the top, it's commonly a year. When you see these melting events, they obviously would occur in the summer times, and you can actually see the summer layers distinguished from the winter layers, and that's sort of like the tree rings, and so they have a different character to them. As you go back down through time, through the ice sheet, and you have more and more pressure on the ice does start to obviously compact and consolidate. And so down at depth, you do progressively lose the annual resolution, but then you keep on with the decade to century scale resolution as you're going down.
Well, tell us, Ross, what was the biggest surprise that you have uncovered and discovered and reported in this type of work that you've been doing?
Yeah, actually, we just recently have been working on a project that is not related to what we've just been talking about, but it is related to something else in terms of the ice sheet behavior and the history of the climate and so on. And that is what's happening underneath the ice. What scientists understand now is that the Antarctic continent is very much like any other continent, where we know now that there is well over 400 lakes on the land sitting underneath the ice. And those lakes are commonly joined by rivers of water that are flowing between the ice and the land. And if everybody understands what happens when you are walking on a rock or solid pavement, it's pretty easy. There's no problems there. But then, say, if you're driving on a wet road, it's very easy to slip and slide on a wet road because the water is providing a lubricating surface between the pavement and the tires of the car. And that's the concept that concerns the scientists down in the Antarctic, is that what is this water film underneath the ice doing, and how much of it is there, how fast is it moving?
So the concept here is that you could lubricate and great swaths of ice and glaciers would simply come into the Antarctic Ocean. Is that one of the issues there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, so if the ice is sitting on rock, it's more likely to be flowing slowly. If it's lubricated by water at the bottom, then it can flow much more rapidly, at the order of miles a year. And when it gets that fast, then it can discharge that ice from this huge mass of ice in the Antarctic into the oceans. And that's the concern of scientists, as that discharge of ice into the ocean to raise sea level.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. Our guest today is Ross Powell, Professor of Geology and Environmental Geosciences, Northern Illinois University. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Though we're in the age of modern medicine, homeopathy continues to have a foothold. You can find the remedies in any drug or health food store.
But an Australian government council wants consumers to take heed. Its study found no reliable evidence that homeopathy is effective.
Just what is homeopathy? It was started by an 18th century German physician who was struggling until his essay proclaiming a new healing art made him famous.
Samuel Hahnemann used tiny doses of illness that causes disease as treatment and highly diluted them. But these doses were diluted to a point that the active ingredients were really no longer in the solution. He insisted the remedies retained or increased their effectiveness if you shook them violently with each dilution.
To examine whether homeopathy really works, the Australian National Health and Medical Research Council analyzed 57 published systematic reviews involving 176 studies.
Only case-controlled studies were considered, meaning they compared a group of patients receiving homeopathic treatments with a control group. To oversee this review, the council assigned a group of experts in conventional as well as alternative medicine.
For a treatment to be considered effective, it must result in health improvements that aren't due to chance, can't be explained by the placebo effect, and must be consistent over several studies.
Before issuing the report, they shared a draft publicly to invite comments, and in the end, concluded homeopathic treatments are ineffective. This should be a wake-up call for people who reject conventional medicine to treat serious conditions.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Ross Powell, Professor of Geology and Environmental Geosciences, Northern Illinois University. But he doesn't spend much time in Northern Illinois. He's usually down there in the Antarctic. And he's been telling us about all the sort of historical features that you can learn about the environment. And then this recent one he just mentioned that, you know, there are lakes down there and rivers underneath the ice. And I didn't know that. And so that's going to cause a certain mobility of one layer over another. Have you been able to show that that has, in fact, been involved in erosion of the ice cap down there?
What we're trying to do in this project, two years ago, we went into one of the lakes that is down there, and we found a wide variety of microbes, and biologically that has been of intrigue to scientists, because if microbes are able to live under half a mile to a mile of ice in this really extreme environment, they could potentially be able to live on some of the icy moons and so on that are out there that the NASA program is interested in exploring. And so biologically, these areas are interesting for understanding life that lives in these extreme conditions.
Tell us a little bit about those little microbes. I mean, are they related to other microbes that you get in glaciers up in the Himalaya or up there in Montana, or are they a species all to themselves?
Yes, it's surprisingly that there are some relative similarities in the communities down underneath the ice sheet that are found in other ice sheets up north in the northern hemisphere. And then there are still some species, the world of microbial biology is still in the process of development. There are so many microbes that are not understood fully at the moment.
So many haven't been discovered either.
Exactly, yeah. So some of them are not understood, but others, there are links to non-organisms in different other icy areas. There was well over 4,000 different species that were found in the lake water.
4,000 different microbes down there in lakes a mile underneath the surface of Antarctica.
Yeah.
Did I get that right?
That's right. And then there was...
You have a job for life, don't you?
Then there was 2,500 or more in the sediments, the muds on the bottom of the lake.
Let's just talk about glaciers in general, because the general public, you know, we see NASA photographs of the Arctic and we see disappearing ice sheets, you know, from time to time. Some of them come back a little, but and then glaciers in Europe up in the Alps seem to be diminishing in their area. And I've been several times up to Montana, the Glacier National Park.
Yeah.
And even just in the period of time that I've been up and down, you know, 20 years, there's much less ice. So this brings us into then climate change. And do your studies give you a particular insight into climate change, that sometimes it's cyclical or is this irreversible? What's your sort of take on that from all your studies?
Yeah, straight up front, I think it is a big concern. And most of the scientists who do this work agree that climate change, global warming is a real thing that is happening and is a big concern. I've been working in these areas since the 1970s. I also work up in the Arctic too, and in Alaska. I study the glaciers in Alaska and up in the European Arctic as well. And
you're a cold weather man, aren't you?
There you go. Yeah.
So anyway, you've seen over this career of, you know, that's 45 or more years.
Yeah.
You understand that there's an issue out there that's perhaps not necessarily taken for the truth by a large segment of the world's population.
I wouldn't necessarily say the world's population, but there are certainly segments of the community that find it difficult to believe or understand. I should say and emphasize that being a scientist, I don't believe in global warming. I understand about global warming because I really want to distinguish between a scientific understanding and a belief that may not necessarily be based on scientific information and data.
Well said. So where are we these days? I mean, let's go back to the concept of cyclical warming and cooling periods. We have ice ages, and then they warm up, and then they come back again. How do you sort of put those two things together today?
Yeah, and that's where the start of our conversation cycles back to us, because one of the best records of understanding the cyclic nature of the warming and cooling of the Earth actually comes from the ice cores. Those samples of gas that are trapped in the ice, samples of the Earth's past atmosphere. And if you melt layer upon layer upon layer and go back year after year and then melt the ice and trap the gases that come out of that melting as you're melting the ice, you can then analyze the samples of the world's atmosphere going back through time. And the key, what are called greenhouse gases, the carbon dioxide, the methane, and the nitrous oxides, the three most important gases for warming, are trapped and analyzed in terms of their concentration in past world atmospheres. And so those records are just absolutely wonderful in terms of giving us a window back in time and seeing how the world has changed. And it has changed, and scientists understand this, that the world has gone through these warming and cooling periods that are naturally occurring through the history of the world. And in fact, the world was much, much warmer when the dinosaurs were running around, and there was a very, very minimal ice on the world, and the dinosaurs were running around at the North Pole and the South Pole.
Yeah, wait a minute. So your point then, let me just go back to that, because the idea of the dinosaurs running around, and there was no ice cap in the Antarctic then.
Right, that's right.
Are we headed in that direction?
Well, potentially, yes. What's more relevant, since that time, the Earth has cooled down quite dramatically, and the world back then was much, much different. There were very expansive and large, very large deserts and dry areas around the world. And so the world's climate back then was very, very different. And that's potentially, you know, the concern is, you know, how much parched land are we going to end up with it with the present warming?
But let me just interject, because that leaves, and there are a lot of people out there that throw this sort of data at scientists and the community in general. Say, look, you know, we've gone through these periods before, and this current trend for warming and glacier melting, etc., is just part of a natural phenomenon.
Yeah, and that's where it comes back to the ice cores again. So the ice cores, as I said, they go back close to a million years, and they provide a record of the concentration of these greenhouse gases, the carbon dioxides and the methane, and also a record of the temperatures that went along. And the temperatures are basically in sync with the amount of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere. As those gases increase, the temperature gets warmer, and then as those gases decrease, the world's temperature cools. And so there's a one-on-one relationship between the amount of these greenhouse gases and the world's temperature. And where we are today in terms of those gases is during the last million years, the concentration of carbon dioxide was running around 280 parts per million in the world's atmosphere. We are now, if you remember, just earlier this year, or was it last year, we actually passed 400. And so we're getting close to doubling the amount of carbon dioxide in the world's atmosphere just over a few decades.
Now, well, hang on. So way back then when the dinosaurs were running around on the South Pole.
That's a different time scale.
I understand.
Yeah. Yep.
What were the levels then? Do you have that sort of data?
There are estimates. We have to use things like corals and stuff to try and work out how much carbon dioxide was in the atmosphere then. But, it was much higher. Just off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly how much it was, but it was at least double the 400.
We're getting close to the end, but I want you, as the expert who has the knowledge, what's the one damning feature that says that what we're going through now is not just a natural swing and that we shouldn't worry about it because there's not much we can do about it, as opposed to the concept of it's anthropological?
Yeah, the most damning thing is the amount of these gases in the atmosphere. We are way beyond the last million year cycle, and none of the changes in the amount of carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere have occurred in a natural cycle at the rate at which it's occurring now.
Okay. So that's where we are, and we could carry on with this conversation. In fact, I think I'm going to wait for you to come back from your last or your next trip, as you put it, up to the Arctic, and we'll do another program because there's just too many things to talk about.
Sure, I'd love that.
Okay. So, Ross Powell, thank you so much for being here, and it's a wonderful career you've carved out for yourself, and it's good to talk to a Kiwi. Great cricket nation, great rugby nation, and a good nation for science, too. I must say that. People just don't have enough understanding of the wonderful science that goes on down there. But anyway, thank you very much for being on Science Studio, and thank you.
Thanks a lot, Keith. It's been great.
Okay, lovely. And we'd like to thank Norma Martinez for putting the program together, and we will be back next week with yet another Science Studio. Bye-bye.